And that, George, I wish that you would come to the next discussion group, because that's the subject I'd like to discuss, to find out if the people up here feel that development is spoiling Alaska.
And again, pardon? You've got to have it to develop.
I know it. Yeah, it's spoiling something that...
From one bucket to the other.
Well, that's true. Thank you, Kate, so much. I'll see you at the bar.
Yes, that is a real problem. I know. I feel caught in this dilemma, because I don't like to see Alaska change. And yet, in a way, to survive, to what extent, you know, we can't live off the country, we can't maintain the comforts of life that we've grown accustomed to without mining and oil and construction and all the things that go with it.
It's a deep subject, any way you want to look at anything anymore.
That's right.
You know, if we didn't have the military here, why, what would have happened to...
That's true, the military has poured tremendous...
And then people don't want it.
Yeah, that's right.
But you've got to have it. National defense is one of our greatest things, I think.
Tell me your name again.
Van Valkenburg. It's a Dutch name.
Was it George?
George.
George Van Valkenburg.
Yeah, discussions is something that you'll contradict yourself as you go.
That's true.
If you're awful careful.
Yeah.
And just like anything else, you know.
Like religion and politics, the economics of Alaska are getting into that same area as religion and politics.
Yes, we are.
What was your name?
Henry Fisher.
Henry Fisher?
Yeah.
When did you come to Alaska?
In 1925.
Where did you go?
Bristol Bay.
What did you do there?
Fish.
You did? That's when you had a sail. That's when you fished with the sails.
No power. Sail.
Yes. Now, where did you fish?
Well, I came up in 1927, and a bunch of us from Washington, Aberdeen, Washington, came up to fish and dig clams for the old Alfordy Company.
You mean commercially?
Commercially, yeah.
I never thought about that, but there was commercial clamming up here, wasn't there?
Oh, yes, that was one of the big deals, even better than fishing.
And where was that?
Well, we started at Kodiak. Not at Kodiak, but that was our main point was Kodiak, but we was on the mainland over, we called it Kukiak Bay, but there's another name for it.
Was that on the Alaska Peninsula
That's
side?
On the mainland, yes.
I see.
And it was still in the Katmai Park, or what they call it now. And we had to pitch our tents right on the open beach. Of course, we had the big tender boats that brought us over. Give us groceries and stuff to start in with.
How many were you?
Oh, there was about 100 of us that year.
Is that right?
And it was pretty stormy weather in the later part of March or April, 1st of April. I guess there was about 4 feet of snow there then. And there was no cabins or nothing. We had to just take a tent and start in with drift logs and build a place to live.
I'm amazed.
And we had skiffs, but no power. And about once a week, the tender from Kodiak would come over and get the clams and take them back, and they canned them there in Kodiak.
Is that right?
And we put in a season there of about, I'd say 3 months, March, April, May, maybe up till June. And then all the boys that could fish would go fishing. And it was the same thing. We did the skiffs and barrels, and we went fishing. And we had to deliver our fish on a scow anchored in a bay somewhere, and just live right in the open skiff and eat when you. That was what we done in them days.
How long would you stay at a time in the skiff?
Oh, the rest of the season, or grab a tent and put it on the beach somewhere.
But how long, when you were out in that skiff, how long would you stay?
Oh, well, there was three of us in a gang, and we had the tender bring us out a tent and a cook stove, and we threw it on the beach.
Oh, I see.
And then we just finished the season there on that one bay. And that was down, we called it Bear Bay, but there's another name for it, Russian name, I don't remember.
And that was that on the mainland across from
Kodiak? That was on the mainland, right down Mirror Bay would be pretty near right across from Kodiak.
Well, I'm curious, going back to the spring clamming, how did you, when you caught the, when you dug the clams?
Well, we had a shovel, a little shovel about so long.
Yeah.
And a short handle. And we had buckets, two 5-gallon buckets. And your clams would show up on the beach, you know, and you just go along. And, you know, I was right-handed, so I'd take the shovel in this hand. And I'd see a clam, I'd just bend over and let it down there and twist the shovel and get in there and grab him. And they were so thick at times. And they was about 7-8 inch.
These are razor clams.
Razor clams, isn't it? That you could just set your buckets in front of you and start digging around them and fill your buckets. Well, we had skiffs to put them in.
I see.
There'd be two of us in a skiff. And it took two good 5-gallon buckets to fill a box, which should be about 60 pounds. And we got $1.25 a box.
Gee, that wasn't very much, was it?
No, because everything then was 50 cents. If you worked, it was 50 cents an hour. If you bought a pound of bacon, it was 50 cents.
Yes.
Of course, the company had a store there, and they'd bring us out whatever we wanted.
But you had to buy your own groceries.
Yeah.
They charged you for them.
Yeah. And
you weren't on rations. I mean,
no,
you were on bed and board on the beach.
If we made $3 a day, that's what we got. If we didn't, we didn't get nothing. But there was days we put in as much as 22 boxes, and that would be about
$30,
which was big money. And then when we went fishing, we got so much of fish. Well, two of us paying about 30,000 fish in a week at 2.5 cents a fish, which was big money.
Yeah?
That was $125 a day.
Well, that was big money.
And that was more than you made in a month anywhere else, some days.
That's right, of course.
And after a while, we got our stuff from there free, you know. The tender fellas would bring us out meat and bread and stuff. So actually, she was making some big money.
I see. And that was, what, 29?
About 27, 28, 29, and 30, long in there.
I see. And did you work for the same company then, year after year?
No, that company sold out to, it changed hands 3 or 4 times in the next 30 or 40 years.
Uh-huh. Well,
it eventually ended up Alaska Packers.
Oh, I see. See, who bought that? I remember, because I came to Anchorage in 49, and I remember hearing talk about the Alaska Packers and the various fishing companies, and I remember the name of the man.
Guy P. Halfordy was the main man that started.
Yes.
And another fellow by Frank McConaughey.
Yes.
And there was a little outfit called the Cape Douglas outfit at it for a little while. And the first year that I worked, there was three men from Aberdeen, Washington, and they called it the Seashore.
Oh.
And now I don't think there's any clams whatsoever. That tidal wave just ruined everything.
Or do you think the tidal wave destroyed those clam beds?
Oh, yeah.
Why do you think that?
Well, later on, in the 40s, about the middle of the 40s, I went to Cordova.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about what they called the clam capital of the world.
Cordova was?
Cordova, Alaska.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And that was a real good, it was a real good job, just digging clams and fishing, because one overlaps the other.
You see what I mean?
When they got through digging clams a season, they had a quota. If they got their quota, they closed down.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't get the quota, why, the clams was going anyway for that year.
Oh.
And, let's see, where was I now? So, that way you can make a pretty good season in 4, 5, 6 months. And later on, when the purse seiners started up there, the gill netters was really about the only ones fishing in them days. Then the big purse seiners come in. Well, it didn't take long to just clean them fish up.
How do you put your net out with a gill net?
Oh, you lay it out. It's piled in your boat, and you just start out and be sure it don't get tangled up. It goes right over the stern of the boat. You just put it in a straight line, more or less.
Yes.
And then when it's out, it drifts. You don't sit there. It drifts with the tide, either one way or back with the flood.
I see. Now, do you have to have the boat stay with it? Or do you set it?
Well, you've got flags on both ends of it.
I see.
Because each person has got a different buoy, a marker, with their name or their number, a color, whatever you want to have. Oh, you can run off ways and just drift around.
I see. But then the...
keep your eye on your net.
The purse seiner came in, and he lets out a net around the fish and makes a loop around them and scoops them up and pulls them in.
Yeah, he
lets
the net out in a more or less in a semi-circle. Then the two ends come together, and then you use a winch to haul in your purse line. And when you get it all in, well, your fish is in that one bag.
Well, now, were you doing any fishing at... not Bear Cove, what, Bear Valley or?
Bear Bay.
Bear Bay. Mm-hmm.
No, this is altogether different vicinity.
Yeah, I know. Cordova's where it is.
Now, them days, they didn't have that kind of fishing.
Well, how did they fish at Bear Bay?
Well, we had little old set nets on the beach. Or lay them out by hand and pick them up by hand.
And just pick the fish out of
them? We didn't even have any power, not even an outboard.
Is that right?
When we had our fish loaded in skiffs. Now, this is down at. The early days.
Yeah.
We had to row them things out about 2 miles. And they'd sink on us, but they'd still float. You see what I mean?
The boat was going lower and lower in the water.
Yeah, and it finally sank with us, but it wouldn't go to the bottom.
Yes, I see what you mean.
You'd be in there with your arms just above the water, rowing to get to that scow.
Is that right?
And, of course, when there's two of us, you know, or three.
Now, you don't mean the gunnels under the water.
Oh, yes.
You really mean...
I've rowed out there with... 3 skiffs, one tied behind the other, with just my arms sticking out rowing. Of course, it was right in the summertime, it was warm. And then we'd tie our skiffs up to the scow and pull them up by hand as far as we could and start unloading. Oh, we'd lose maybe 500-600 fish. But there was so many fish in them days that I've seen, we got around one school there that had over 150,000 dogs in it. That's the dog salmon.
Yeah.
And we just had to let them go or we'd lose our net.
Is that so?
You could actually walk on them things.
Oh, that was a purse seiner?
No,
no.
Just our little old beach seiner.
That was your little old beach seiner?
And all we could handle was 6,000 a day.
My word.
And that was no trouble. We'd have them inside of 2 hours. The biggest part was unloading.
Getting them out to the scow.
To the scow, so the tender could come in. Because this is all shallow flats in, you see.
I see.
And the big boat couldn't get into where we was.
Yeah.
But at high water, they could. But chances are they wouldn't be anywhere near us then at high water.
I see.
So we had to do that.
Gosh, that's amazing. No, I've never heard of that.
There was bear there, lots of bear.
Yes.
The big
grizzly. The big grizzly, the brownies, Kodiak brownies.
We've counted as high as 15, 18 in the herd. They'd be back in kind of in a, you know what I mean, a kind of a swale up in there, eating fish and playing around. They never bothered
us. They never bothered you.
And we was camped right on the beach without a gun even.
Is that right? They never...
They never heard our tent or nothing. Oh, that was quite an experience.
Oh, that must have been a marvelous experience,
and,
really.
We only fished there about 10 days that fall. That was more or less than the end of the season.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, had you been clamming all season before that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was all, the whole season was clamming, digging clams.
Most of it, yes, up until July.
Well, did you row the clams out to the scow the same way?
Where we was there, boy, the tender come up, there was a lagoon that come in. And he'd come up in that lagoon, and then we'd throw him on the boat for him.
Yes. You know, that kind of reminds me, I was out one time there, and I was out on Sitkanak Island. And there was an otter. I was involved in the mining. In fact, the Sheely brothers, what was Sheely, was it, at Kodiak? There was Tom, I think, had made a find of some black sand and gold and stuff on the beach. And it was an iron ore. What do you call it? Oh, it was a mixed bag of of minerals, but my former husband was a mining engineer, and so we went out to investigate it, making an evaluation of the beach of San Foy. So we camped on Sitkanak Island, which is one of the Trinity Islands. We were almost in sight of Kodiak. Kodiak was on the horizon, but we were south and on the west end of Kodiak. And it was a good-sized island. It was 15 miles over the hill to a Coast Guard station that was on the east end of the island. But where we were on the west end, we camped in a big sand dune, and then the beach sand that we were examining was way down around the beach. So we had to walk down this lagoon to get there. And when we walked down along the shore of the lagoon, an otter would come out from its den in the sand dunes. And it would come over and dive in the lagoon and swim down alongside of us and chatter. It would just go along for company. It was just fun. But so you were speaking of the animals and the bears, and I was just thinking of that. But anyway,
there were lots of little red foxes there, too.
Were there?
Oh, them things got so tame, they'd come right down and eat clams out of your hand.
Is that so? They're a fascinating animal. They do get
tame. Yeah, they sure are. They think it's fun to watch them dig a clam.
Oh, really?
They know where that clam is. Because a clam makes a little hole like that. You
know? Oh, they know the bubble.
And sometimes their neck will be sticking up. But if you just touch that neck will go down, that clam will start digging.
Mm-hmm.
And that little fox or what big one or whatever it is, he'll just keep, pretty soon he's got the clam. They used to come down and eat right out of our boxes. They got so lazy.
Oh, my.
And we didn't bother.
No. You kind of spoiled them.
Yeah.
You left them eat. When you were fishing in Bristol Bay, how would you, when you would go out?
Huh?
When you went fishing, how did you fish?
Didn't.
Can you tell me about it?
Huh?
Can you tell me about it?
Then it's so huge, you got 5.5 days a week. Monday morning, 6 o'clock. Till Saturday evening, 6 o'clock. Then you quit. And it was pretty rugged, I must have heard. Nothing to eat.
Not even a raw fish?
Then I had another sandwich, eat raw fish.
That was rough. That was rough. Couldn't you take food out with you?
Yes, a little bit. And the telescope to feed you when you deliver fish. That was pretty rough. Now it's all right, it gets better.
That was all sailboat.
Yes, I remember. I've seen pictures.
I quit fishing no more.
What's wrong with
it? What was this?
I can't see either.
Oh, this is a tape for the university about stories of early Alaska.
Early Alaska.
You're a pioneer.
I am, no.
Sure.
I'm Bristol Bay.
Well, that's part of Alaska.
I don't know.
Did you live at Dillingham?
No.
Where did you live?
Leavelock.
Leavelock?
You know where that is. Kwikyak River.
Kwikyak.
Kwikyak.
Yes. Did you live there all year round?
I've been 45 years. Alaska's God's country.
Alaska's God's country, I agree with you. Have you heard of any, had you heard him tell of any of his experiences?
Not too much. It's hard to talk with him.
Yeah. If you were going to write a book, what experience would you tell about?
Nothing. I have a good mind, I mind my own business. What do you intend to do? Write books?
No, I don't write books. I said, just meant if you were going to,
yeah,
you know, what kind of stories would you want to tell about your life?
Nothing.
Nothing. Now, you know, anybody that fished out there for 45 years had some experiences.
I could not tell you.
Well,
I'm going to Bahama pretty soon.
Yeah, but you're not there yet.
No, how do you know? One of our friends, he bent up yesterday, the day before.
Yes, I heard. I heard about that, yes. Well, I plan to go. I've never been there, but I'm supposed to go to South Naknek. Did you know Harry Gottschalk? Did you ever hear of Harry Gottschalk?
Yes.
I heard he mushed his dogs clear to Siberia. He mushed his dogs to Siberia.
Yeah, two of them.
Is that right?
And he was the only one who let live. His pilot died. Came from Siberia, over the ice, docked him in 1913. Mike got shot, yeah. He's still in Mike. He's 2 or 3 years older than I am.
Is that so? Did you mush dogs?
Sure. We had no cars, no school bus. Dog team. You want to go someplace? Dog team.
Did you ever go through the ice?
Me? No. I stay away from the river. I fished through the ice in the winter time.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah. Plenty. All of them. You see a bunch of women sitting there in the morning. The whole day long fish. Rainbow trout, belly barn, smelt. That's the only kind of fish, but it's a big.
That's a great country over there.
I've never been there.
I've never been there either, but I've heard stories of the fishing. And you know that that business of fishing under sail without the power, that I wish I knew enough about it to ask him, you know, how they... How did you take when you were fishing under sail? How did you take your boats out with the sail? Would you go out in a group?
You go wherever you feel like. It's up to you. Sail where it's all right. Fair wind, fair tide. No wind, no tide.
You row.
You pull. Two men. We usually get 15 cents from King Salmon. 15. 7.5 for you, 7.5 for me. Now I don't know what to pay. $4 or $5.
How big was your boat?
28 feet.
Well, that's a big boat.
Good. They generally work with the tide.
How far out? How far out would you go?
That's by the Bureau of Fisheries. You go below the limit stake and above the limit stake, you can't go. Especially where you fish. New laws all the time. Now and more fish, the Japanese that get the fish. How come? Japan was broke in 1945. Outside us, they built boats for Japanese, power boats. Go to Bristol Bay, lots of fish. They come over here. South Korea's coming too. It's not getting better, it gets worse.
That's the truth, yeah?
And there's nothing you can do about it. Politics. Money talks. Might is right.
Can't argue with you. I can't argue with you.
No.
Tell me, how about with the big water? How did you fish and during the storms?
It's not too bad, yes. If not, you go home in a hurry as you go. Somebody drowned every year.
Oh, yeah.
Every year.
Terrible up there. Rough water. You know, they're greedy. They want to get all the fish they could. A lot of them get caught.
Why would some drown every year?
They live there. You get there's bars. You get stuck on the bars.
You get stuck on the bars?
You can have water to float. It's fine weather. It's nothing to it. But it's rough weather. You swamp before you even get off the bar.
The boats would swamp before they could get off the bar.
Yeah, and do drown.
I see. Now, when the power boats came in, did that help that? Did it make it any better?
You could go from one bay to another. Fish on the west side, and you're on the east side. It's about 15, 40 miles across. You get a power boat, there's nothing to it. You get the fish. 40,000, 50,000 fish in a season, 1 month. You fish 5.5 days a week.
I'm going over town. I left a note for you.
Okay, good. Thanks, Kay. Yeah, go on.
Huh?
Did you work for a different cannery or the same cannery always?
Not different cannery. Alaska Packers, Nakeem, Portland Packers.
Now, would you take you take your boat to a scow or bring your fish back to a cannery, or how would you do it?
I'm the scout out in the middle of Panga. And you throw up a fish, they clip. They count every fish you deliver. And they mark it down in the book, fishing book. But they didn't pay nothing. Now, I don't know.
I don't know either. No, I said I don't know how the pay is compared to, but I think it's pretty good today.
I don't know. The wages go down and the prices go up.
I always heard that fishermen made big money, though.
Sure, big money. Where's the money?
That's a good question, isn't it?
You know, I've often wondered about that. You can always hear somebody tell the big days, but never the poor ones. There's some seasons that you put in for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just don't make a nickel.
There just aren't any fish.
Well, something you might break down or something, you know, your boats or your gear. It's a poor season. There's so many things that could happen. Well, now, like these fellas that own boats, they're worth... We're talking about these purse seiners, you know. $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 boats. They've got to make some big money to pay insurance and the upkeep and the principal and everything. Some of them just don't do it. There's a few that makes pretty good every year. The ones that don't make it are just, they've lost their time and they're kept. You know, it isn't all big money.
Yeah, well, if a man has a fishing boat and he has to pay it off, I suppose he could lose his...
Lose
everything, yes. Gee, I was down in Wrangell one time, too, and I was hitching a ride on a shrimp boat from Petersburg over to Wrangell, but that was a big boat. It was in the winter, and he was hauling shrimp over, but it was a year-round fishing boat. I was trying to think how big that boat was. I don't know, I think it was 90 feet or something.
Yeah.
It was that beautiful boat. But that's a case where a man had to make a lot of money to pay for that boat. I can see what you mean.
What year was that?
I was 57.
57, that boat had run way up in the 100,000s.
Is that right?
Oh, sure.
Is that so? I had no idea. Howard White, Sunday.
In 57, I think that boat had run you from $150,000 to $200,000.
I see.
And if it was equipped for different types, it's still another $20,000, $30,000 for gear.
I see. Of course.
Like the king crab fishermen, well, gee whiz. They made it all right in that, but there's a lot of them lost their boats and their lives and their gear.
King crab business out of Kodiak.
That's the center of it. We really started that. I went to Bristol Bay up where he fished there. We was around Port Mooar.
Yes.
You know where that is.
Yeah, I was trying to think.
That year was either 47 or 48, and that was the RFC, and they sent 13 big purse seiners up there to find out where fish, different things was, you know. And I was lucky. I got on the big Kiska out of Astoria, Oregon.
Oh, yes.
That was for Columbia River Packers. And we had a crew of seven men, and we used the Great Atlantic Trawl. That's a bottom fish net. And they'd send us this place and that place and all over. And we fished all the way up into the Pribilofs.
Is that right?
Well, we was guaranteed $2,750 to make the trip. And if we made more, we got all that over and all of our expenses. Well, we went into that king crab business off of Port Mooar. I forget that little island below us. If I had a map, I could show you. And we got into a mess of king crab there, and we had that big trawl on the bottom. And we picked up over 6,500 crab in one drag.
Is that right?
And we used that Great Atlantic trawl.
That's not like an otter trawl.
Yeah, it's about the same thing. I mean, this was enormous. We used a log chain for lead line, so it would stay on the bottom.
Yes.
And we had that big Kiska, which was 98 footer, with 250 horsepower.
I've seen a boat called a Kiska, and I don't remember where I've seen it tied up, but I've seen it somewhere.
Well, anyway, we got so much a dozen for them. I forget what it was, $4.50 or $5 a dozen. And we've picked up crab there that would measure 78 inches. That's further than I can
My
reach.
My word, nearly 6 feet across.
And this one crab
7 feet.
Cut out over 8 pounds of meat. And their legs, his legs is bigger than my arm.
As big as your arm.
And they processed this on the big process boat, the Pacific Explorer.
My mouth started to water.
They had a big crew there. They had 125 Filipinos. And we had to deliver to this boat. And the way they done that, they'd cook the crab. And I don't think they used the body meat at all then. I think they just threw that away. And they'd run these legs through a bandsaw just to fit a can, a 1 pound tall, and then they'd hand back in.
They would shell it first.
No. They'd cook it. And then
they'd cook it and then run it through the saw.
And then they'd shake this meat.
And shake the meat out.
There was meat that big around and just in, and then they'd pack it into the cans.
Oh my.
Well, if that was nowadays, that one crab would be worth about $35.
Yes, it would. That's right.
$4 a pound.
That's right.
Pounds of meat.
That's the truth.
We get $30 now.
Sure.
And we got 50 cents. About 40 cents we got.
Oh, my.
So you can just figure the change.
Yes,
the way
sure.
Things is.
Now, when would that have been, 31 or 2?
No, this was in the late 40s.
In the late 40s. I
think you remember when Truman was in.
Yeah.
And Walgreen for governor of Washington.
Yeah.
And Nick Baez. Everybody knows Nick Baez.
Yes.
Well, the three of them got together, and this was a government job.
Yeah, it is, as a matter of fact.
Well, anyway, that was all supposed to went into charity.
Is that right?
For somehow, nobody ever knew where it
was. I can seal this and, put it away for 100 years, so.
But you can see that. But we made good money.
Uh-huh.
We had to deliver the boat back to Oregon.
I see.
And when we got it all settled up, I'd drawn a lot of money and a lot of sea stores and this and that and whiskey and this and that and the other. And I got paid off around $4,000 for the 3 months.
Well, that wasn't too bad for 3 months' wages.
Not in them days.
In those days, that's right.
Clear money. Of course, this big tax has come out of too.
Yeah, yeah.
I forget how much tax came out of it.
Yeah. But you really did some crab exploring there.
And that's where the king crab. The king crab really started with, I forget that. What is that man's name there in Kodiak? He had the deep sea, and he was fishing up in that country. And he done his processing right on his boat.
Oh, really?
Wakefield.
Yeah, sure. He was at Saldovia. Was he at Kodiak, too? I just knew Wakefield, Canada,
Saldovia. Up there, and then there was two brothers that had the Chirikoff out of Kodiak. And that was about the first of the king crab.
I see.
And after they found them different beds of king crab, like, then everybody jumped right into it.
I see. Sure, wouldn't
but,
see.
Thank God, if we... The only trouble with dragging, they made them quit that, though, because they killed too many of the crabs.
With the dragging?
Yeah. You know, they'd sand down, you know. And they're just like a fish. If they get sanded, the gills and everything, while they're dead. And then the females, too, you know. Of course, you can only take the males. The little females are just small.
And you throw those back?
You got to throw them back, and they'd be all busted up. And millions of them destroyed. You know, they just quit that right away.
I see. The
but
trawl.
They had to find out where they was.
I see.
You see, you've always got to find first. Just like oil or gold or anything else, you got to find it first.
Yes.
So that give a lot of people work. Well, I guess there's over 300-400 worked on that project.
That many?
Well, with the cannery crew and everything.
Sure.
13 boats, about 10 men average. That's 130, 125, 250, about 300 altogether.
Huh. Well, when did you go to Kodiak? About 30, 31?
No, about 26 or 7. 27, I think, the first
I don't
time.
Mean Kodiak. I meant Cordova.
Oh, in the 40s, middle 40s.
To Cordova? Oh, well then did you live there for some time?
Oh, yeah.
And you fished out of Cordova?
Yes.
You know, I have a funny story about that, and this is one of those stories that just let it go, I guess. But
well, no, it's a small town.
Well, no, this isn't that kind of a story. But I got very, I accidentally drank too much one time, and I was horrible. The only time in my life I've ever been hungover. You know, see, I'm trying to be a lady. See, I have to tell it that way. So it's the truth. But anyway, I was so hungover. I was so sick. And so I was, a couple of weeks later, my husband and I were down in here in Anchorage. We were downtown. We stopped into a bar, and he met a fellow he knew. And this kid asked us to have a drink. And I said, no. I said, I can't look at this stuff. I just, you know, sort of accidentally drank too much, and I was so sick. And I was telling him about it. So that's how he told me this story. He says, oh, he says, I was sick one time. He says I drank too much in Cordova one time, and he says, I was fishing. And he said, I had to go out back on board the boat the next day, and he said, they were halibut fishing with long lines. And he said, I had to pull up those lines. And he says, I didn't mind the fish, but it was the starfish. And he says, every time I'd hit one of those starfish, it'd get to me. And anyway, I guess that there's all kinds of fishing out of Cordova.
There's quite a bit there now. I mean, they've got the crabs. The clams are gone.
The clams are gone.
That earthquake destroyed the clams.
Is that
right? I'll tell you why. The clam lives in the tidewater, mostly.
In the shallow water?
Yeah, where it goes dry and floods back.
Yes.
But when the tidal wave hit, as I was in Cordova at the time, and this is another part of this story. There was company shacks along the beach. There was 11 of them, and there was room for 4 men in a cabin. And there was about, this was early, of course, that was what, March the 27th?
I think so, yeah.
Well, anyway,
Good Friday, whatever it was.
There was only 7 of us there, because it was early. And when that tidal wave come in through the Orca Inlet, and Cordova was about 12 miles up in there, and we was down here, you know. And when that earthquake hit about 5:30 in the evening, well, the boys, we all had radios, and the tide would come in, and then it would go out as much as 30 or 40 feet, and then it would come right back in and come way up above high water. Well, it pretty near drove us guys crazy. And finally, it come about 11 o'clock, and I told one of the guys, I'm going back and go to bed. And he says, no, you better stay here so we can get up this mountain. I went back to my cabin, which is about halfway between all of them in there. And that darn water was right up pretty near to my cabin again. So I went back and stayed with some of the fellas there so we could get up that, through a path up on the hill. And about that time, they said, everybody at White Shed, get up as high as you can. And we just barely got up there, and that hit us. And it put 26 feet of water over the cabins and everything. And them cabins just got up and left and started floating right out to sea like a freight train. We didn't have one solid thing left. And we lost one man. No, but we found him about 3 weeks later out, way out in one of the Egg Islands. That was an experience if you ever had one.
Holy mackerel, the last wave was the biggest.
The big one. That's when Chenega got it. They got a 94-foot wave that hit them all at once. We was at that village later on in the summer, and we could see just how high the water had come up on the... And their cabins is down pretty on the, just above high water, you know.
Yeah, pretty much of the entire village of Chenega was wiped out, as I recall.
Well, they lost
Tetitlik and Chenega both were pretty well wiped out.
Tetitlik, yeah. They lost just half of the people that lived there.
At Tetitlik, you mean? Or Chenega?
Chenega. I think it was 78, and they lost 34.
I see. Just roughly half.
Cordova only lost one man.
That one man there.
One man died of heart failure at the time.
Of the earthquake.
Some older fella.
Now, you see, I was up in Fairbanks, and we didn't get, you know, we got, as a matter of fact, I tell you what, I was in the university dining room. I was with a girlfriend who was a geophysicist, and she had just come from some college on the East Coast. And I asked her, I said, I looked at my watch. My dad was an engineer, And he was always interested in earthquakes. So when this thing started to shake, we were at dinner, and there were big rafters like this. And I looked at my watch, and normally earthquakes will last 10 or 15 seconds. And I was watching, my second hand was going around, and after 3.5 minutes, I turned to this girl and I said, "This is a big earthquake." I said, "Somewhere there's some damage being done." And she said, "Oh," she says, "I know all about it." She just come up, real chichaka. She says, "I know all about these Alaska earthquakes." She says, "You know, they're nothing." And she says, "You have them all the time." And I said, "Yeah, but not this long." And then after four minutes, it was a pretty good shake up there. I moved out from underneath the beam because I was afraid this was no mean jiggling. So, of course, it knocked the seismograph off the table up there. But this was a pretty tame experience compared to what some people went through.
Now, this might sound funny to you or a lot of people, but we had one or two dogs in the camp and two or three cats.
Yeah.
And all morning long, them cats and dogs is a howling, and they'd run up the hill and howl and come back. I think the atmosphere, the pressure was telling them animals that there's something coming.
I don't know what it is.
They say the cows down in Chirikoff down in there done the same thing.
They went up the hill.
And they'd bawl and make noises.
Is that right?
Yes. No, I believe that.
Well, I had a girlfriend in Anchorage who said that she had a visual phenomena. It was like she was looking at electricity, like lightning in the air all the time. She kept seeing these streaks of lightning in the air around her, and she thought her eyes were going bad or something. And then after the earthquake, it stopped. She could see this, some strange phenomenon.
No doubt.
And I know up in Fairbanks, I was nervous. I was going to school, and I could hardly go to school every day. For about 3 or 4 days before that, I got sicker and sicker, and I thought maybe it's school pressure. I couldn't imagine what was wrong with me. And then right after the earthquake, I was no more problem. I just didn't feel anything. I wasn't, you know how women are, and I thought, well, my gosh, what's the matter with me? What kind of a womanly problem is this or something, you know?
Well, that was terrible.
Did you feel any sense of pressure?
I didn't get excited. I didn't get scared till afterwards. So yeah. I looked at everything and said, "My God, there's nothing left here."
Is that right?
And then I started to get shaken and sick, and we didn't have one thing left. Nothing.
Is that right?
Just a day like we.
You mean the house washed away with everything?
All of our clothes and groceries and equipment and skiffs. Well, everything just got up and moved.
Well, here you are, a working fisherman, and your business has been wiped out.
We didn't have one nickel. I even lost what money I had in my pocketbook because I left it in that shack.
Is that right?
And all, you know. Well, you had a lot of things there, like pictures and stuff.
Of course.
That I've had for 50 or 60
yes.
years.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You just said goodbye, just like you.
Where was your home originally? Where were you born? Like,
I was born in Wichita, Kansas.
Oh, you were? Oh. And you grew up there in Kansas?
No. We left there in 1912. And we settled in Southern California.
Did you?
And then we moved up to the middle of California in the San Joaquin Valley.
Oh, when did you move there?
About 1915.
Oh, whereabouts?
At Porterville.
In Porterville. Oh, in the foothills of the...
Yeah, in the Orange Belt there.
Yeah. My grandmother and my grandfather moved there before the turn of the century. My grandfather was a real estate broker in San Jose, but he dealt in ranches in San Joaquin Valley, Sacramento Valley properties in San Jose. Clara Valley.
And then I moved up into Oregon and Washington, and well, that's where I come to Alaska from Washington.
I see. So you grew up on the coast, almost.
Yeah, I might as well say that I've been on salt water all my life as far as...
Yes.
I always liked the sea, done a little traveling here and there.
Did you ever make a sea voyage?
Oh, yeah.
You did?
I made several trips across the Pacific, Japan, China, and the Philippines, and that kind of...
Was that with the Navy?
No, this was before I went to Alaska.
Uh-huh. Hmm.
But like I say, in the clams at Cordova, the reason they're gone, when that earthquake and everything was over, the ground had come up 4 to 6 feet. Well, that put everything dry where these clam beds had been.
I see.
And afterwards, there was that much clams and coffee and all kinds of stuff on the ground when everything was over. Hmm. It just ruined thousands and thousands of tons of stuff.
Wonder where he was in the earthquake. Where were you in the earthquake?
Huh? Up in Bruce and Bay. In 67.
Where do you live?
Bruce and Bay.
Did it affect?
The lump. A little bit.
Just a little bit.
The natives, look. I didn't say nothing. They didn't know. They didn't put a lot of water outside. The water was earthquake. You want to see an earthquake, you got to go to Japan.
Were you there? Did you see an earthquake?
I was in Japan, yes. But before the First World War, I was in China 2.5 years. Tsingtao.
What were you doing there?
In German Navy.
Me. Ooh.
It was a fire truck.
Looks all right. What did you do there?
What do you do in the Navy?
I don't know.
I'm one of the crew.
I see.
I was a fireman.
Was that on the Yangtze River?
Tsingtao, General Sea, China. The Germans got there from China after the Boxer Rebellion, 1900. And Tsingtao was home port, but we never stayed. We traveled all the time, South Island.
Beautiful place.
Huh?
That's a beautiful place.
Yeah, some of them places. Fiji Island is pretty good. Suva, British. Samoa's all right. New Guinea's no good. The climate is no good.
You're right.
Solomon Islands, no good.
You're right.
Headhunters.
You're right. I've heard about that.
The Ikis.
They still do, too.
Well, sure.
I read about that not long ago. There was an incident.
I came to Alaska in 1923, down below. But I was no citizen. And they asked me, I shipped out, were you born Henry? U.S. I knocked down U.S. I'm American. And every time you come on port, immigration, look at the lock, the crew. Oh, Henry Fisher, he's an American. But I got scared. Some of the days they're going to catch me, they sent me back to Germany. I came up to Alaska. Now I'm a citizen.
George, have you seen those girls?
Well, I've seen them come in and out. I don't know where they
are. I came back from Siberia. I was 2.5 years in prison in Siberia. After the war. 800 Earth. We went from Kiel, Germany to Sebastopol. Down the Black Sea, Russian naval base. And when the war ended, 11th of November, I think, 1980, we were stuck down in Russia. And the commissary comes and says to me, we got to run the Red Army. Punch my Pelosi? No, you don't talk Russian. Crossing the army. Yes, no, I told him. I'm not an army guy, I'm a navy guy. Talk to you both about it. You're in Russia. I went to Irkutsk. That's on Lake Baikal. That lake is about 400 miles long. And in 21, they told me to go home. From that Irkutsk. Awful. I got home in Germany. I got a job right away because I came from Siberia 2 years, 3 years after the war. And I got to Jacksonville, Florida. Goodbye. I stayed.
No. You were at Irkutsk.
Huh?
You were at Irkutsk during the war? You stayed there in Siberia after the war?
I had a revolution in Russia. In September 1970, and Germany took all the Russian Manowarsaw went to Sebastopol.
How did you get to Irkutsk?
The Russians had me in prison. I wasn't joined the Red Army. I was used.
I see. How did you get away from there?
There were over 900 people in Russia, different nationalities, and the other parts in Europe. They put pressure on the Russians, and they let them go.
Did you take the train out? Did you come out by train?
Jumped the train on top of the roof.
You did?
Yeah.
That Trans-Siberian Railway?
That's only one line they get. One line.
And you rode the top of the car?
Yeah.
What time of year was it?
That was in May.
Pretty warm then.
Warm nothing.
Up. No?
I had a good coat with 3 colors.
Wow.
I came from Moscow. The Mansky Bureau, German Bureau. And the guy, he was in charge there. Lots of Russians, Germany sent. They tried to get into Germany, get away from Russia. He asked me my name, where I was born, and told him. He had a rifle in his hand. He threw it at me, and I grabbed the right away. I trained in the Navy, Army. They asked me, present arms and all that stuff. Sure, you're right. I come back, Hamburg, Germany. Nothing to eat, no jobs, nothing, no ships, nothing. In 21, after the First World War, well, I didn't start the war. I came to God's country here.
My, that's a story. Isn't that something?
Huh?
That's quite a story, I said.
Story.
What did you do when you got to Florida?
Florida.
You came to Florida.
On a German ship.
Yes.
I shipped out on the oil tanker. Go through my oil tanker, Port Arthur, Texas. 6 weeks. And then I quit. 4 of us. And they bought a car, 4 children car. We went to San Pedro, California. All the way from Texas. Well, I got a job, number 2 months. Oh, about 8 months, I come up to Alaska. And I've been here still in Alaska.
Is that when you went to Bristol Bay?
Yeah, fishing company.
Well, that was a
packing company.
That was a hard life at Bristol Bay.
Hard life.
Did you marry?
Huh?
Did you get married?
Yes.
Where did you meet your wife?
I got 2 daughters. I got no wife. I'm single.
You didn't get married. You got married?
Who?
Me? Did you ever get married?
Yes.
And you have 2 daughters?
I got 3. One is in Kent, Washington. He got 4 kids.
You're a grandfather?
I got 21 grandchildren.
How about that?
21.
That's wonderful.
10 in Naknek.
You have?
In Naknek, yeah. You know Naknek?
I've never been there, no.
You've heard about it.
Yeah, I've heard about it, oh yeah.
And Harold Gottschalk, he calls himself Mike now. I know him well. He came once from Siberia, over the ice floes, 2 of them. His partner died, I think in Rome.
Hmm.
He comes from close where I come from, Harold Gottschalk. He's a German. Yeah.
Did he mush to Alaska? Did he come to Alaska through Siberia? Is that how he got here? I don't know. I don't know.
1913, that was before my time.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that story. Yeah. Where did you meet your wife?
Oh, but in Alaska.
Well, you lived a good many years there on the Kavichak.
Me?
Yeah.
45 years.
Yeah.
Good place.
Is it?
Yeah.
Good fish.
No cars.
No cars. Yeah.
That's the type of here. No docking.
I agree with you. Yeah.
You go to Angus, we are crazy. No good.
Fast cars.
Are you from Fairbanks?
Yes.
Do you know a fellow by name? He's a senator. Butrovich?
Oh yes, John Butrovich.
He was in my house in Libra.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
Oh.
His brother, not his brother, his brother-in-law, John Maggie, teacher from Oregon. He used to be kicked in Leavelock, about 10 years.
How big is Leavelock?
They had about 95 people.
I see. With a roadhouse?
Huh?
You got a roadhouse there?
No roadhouse.
No. Just a cannery?
Oh, the cannery is no more. That was 2 years and it went broke. But I stayed there.
Did the town get there because of the cannery? Did the cannery make the town?
I don't think so. I think they had a town there before.
Wonder what started the town. Was there anything besides
Nobody knows.
Yeah, I see.
Nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
There's one place I used to fish. Libby's. Graveyard, they call it. Libby's Cogging now. youth brigade, the native village, close to the river. And the river, it's a bank away, all the graves come down. Just skeletons. That's why they call it graveyard. That's a long time ago.
But a good place to fish. That was a good place to fish?
Well, the whole river, not Mackinac, but Kwikset. You get all kinds of different rivers. Mushigak, Mackinac, Ee. I forget.
Tell me something. What's the most important thing for a man to know who was fishing under sail? To keep alive, what's the most important thing?
Know the river. You know how the river is? But that's not the idea. You get two nets out in the water. 150 fathoms, that's 600, 900 feet. But the wind pushed an arrow that way. You can see it. The first thing you know, you're stuck on a bar. Fine weather, the tide comes in, you're it, you go. But it's rough, blown. Goodbye for you.
Stay off the bar.
Very good. You don't want to go on the bar, but the wind didn't put you, the wind.
I see.
Best thing is stay away from the river.
I see. Well, that was a beautiful thing to see. I've seen the pictures of the boats going out under sail.
Oh, yeah,
it was beautiful.
Yeah.
Did you see that? Were you ever there when they went out?
No, I've never been there. I was only in Bristol Bay that one.
When you were trolling?
No, deep sea.
Yeah.
No, I've never watched gillnet up there, but I know what it is because I've done gillnet myself.
Yeah.
And the way they get grounded is like he says. You'll be fishing along and your boat goes dry and the tide's going out. Well, you just sit there till that tide comes in, and when that tide comes, it's so rough, comes so fast, it'll just keep it. Pretty soon your boat's full.